Ladies and gentlemen, I would like you to please welcome a very inspirational young man from the UK called Jody McIntyre.
This guy is amazing. Do you know him?
No.
Brace yourself for a show.
How old is he?
Okay. 19.
First of all, I'd just like to thank everyone for coming to this important event and also to thank Loki for that amazing introduction. For the last 9 months of my life, I've been with the people living under a brutal military occupation. From Palestinians in East Jerusalem being evicted from their homes to make way for foreign settlers, to Palestinians in the West Bank marching towards the wall to protest against the theft of their land, to Palestinians in Gaza suffering under a crippling siege every day. But I want to start my story last summer in Jerusalem. I was living with the Hanun family in the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah. It was August the 1st, the day after my 19th birthday, and I got a call from a girl called Jenna, one of the daughters of the family. And she phoned me to say that she would like to make a birthday cake to celebrate. So we had a very enjoyable and relaxing evening, listening to music, eating the cake, and all the family were there. Little did I know that only a few hours later, at around 5 o'clock, in the morning, I would hear the sound of bricks flying through the kitchen windows, and I would see armed Israeli soldiers rushing through the front door. By the time they got to the front room, where I was lying down to rest, I realized that the Hanun family, this family that had become like my own family, were being evicted from their home. By the time I was out on the street, they didn't even let me put my shoes on my feet. As they pushed me down the stone steps outside, I saw my wheelchair to the left, and I explained that I needed it because I can't walk. Israeli police told me that they didn't care and continued to push me away from the house. There were around 20 other foreigners and Israelis also staying with the family to show their support and solidarity, but they were all arrested within less than a minute. But when the police officer came to me last and asked me, "Where are you from?" I replied in Arabic, "I'm sorry, but I don't understand English." But I will never forget what I heard the head of the police tell his officer after he heard my response. He said, "Don't worry about him, he's only a Palestinian." And I think that is an important statement, and it stayed with me for a long time, because this represents the mindset of the Israeli state. From the Israeli government implementing these discriminatory policies the Israeli occupation forces carrying out their dirty work, to the settlers stealing people's homes. That Palestinians are not important and are not human beings in the same way that Westerners are human beings. We were forced across the road, and just an hour later, watched as American citizens and British citizens moved into our home. I saw Jenna, the same 16-year-old girl who had called me a few hours before to say that she wanted to make me a birthday cake, now with tears pouring from her eyes, completely distraught. And she said to me, "This is the second time I've been kicked out of my home, so how can I ever forget?" I remember seeing Maha, the family, the father of the family, talking to the one or two reporters who had managed to sneak past the police blockades, and I'd seen Maha tell the story of their family's plight 1,000 times before with no problem. But this time, he broke down halfway through. He couldn't finish his words, and that hurt me more than anything. I stayed with the family for the next couple of weeks, sleeping now on the pavement opposite their home. We watched as the settlers walked in and out, joking and high-fiving with the soldiers, sitting on the steps where we used to sit to pass the time, playing football in the streets that we used to play on. But like all the Palestinians I met during my time there, the Hanun family was so strong. The day after the eviction, I saw Shelly Han, one of Jenna's cousins, a 20-year-old girl studying psychology, talking to people that had gathered to hear our story with a huge smile beaming across her face. She said, "They want the Arabs to be stupid so that when we shout, no one will hear our voices. But I will never give up. I will continue to study and to work hard." Now, Shelly Han had an exam 3 days after the eviction, and the school phoned her and said, "Of course we understand your situation. You don't have to sit this exam." But she said, "No, I want to." And she did her revision right there on the street, took her exam 3 days later, and got the highest mark in her year. So I think... she can serve as an inspiration to us all. Also, the day after the eviction, I got a call from a friend of mine in Belaim, a small village in the West Bank, to tell me that at the same time as we were being evicted in Jerusalem, 200 soldiers had invaded the village and arrested 7 people. I went back, but little did I know at the time that Belaim would become my home for the next 6 months. Can you start the photo? Excuse me, you said. Thank you. Of course, Belaim isn't just any ordinary village. It is situated right on the apartheid wall that Israel has built that has stolen over half their land. Now, being a traditional farming village, many farmers lost everything they ever owned when the wall was constructed. Now, every Friday for the last 5 years, and that's going back to when construction on the wall began, the people of Belaim marched to the wall to non-violently protest against their theft of their land, together with Israeli activists and supporters from around the world. Can you go a bit further on slideshow? Okay. Now, and every week, so for 6 months, I marched with them. And every week, without fail, we were met with the full force of the Israeli army. Clouds of tear gas, deafening sound grenades, rubber-coated steel bullets, and even live ammunition. In response to the non-violent demonstrations, the Israeli army launched a campaign of intimidation and harassment against the people of Belayim. For 4 months straight, the Israeli army would raid the village every night, dragging young teenage boys from their bed, some as young as 13 or 14 years old, and throwing them in jail for months on end, purely for the fact that they participated in the demonstrations. Now, when I first arrived in the village, these were just any people being arrested. But as 1-2 months passed, these became my close friends and people that I was chatting to and hanging out with in the day, being taken from us at night. And the invasions were not only limited to the nights. Sometimes the army would even come in the day just to harass the people of Belayim. During one such invasion in the day, the head of the army went to the mother of the family I was living with, one of the closest houses to the wall, and he said to her, "If these weekly demonstrations don't stop, we're going to come back and blow up your house." So it's a wonder that we got any sleep around there. But more than this, I want to tell you about the people of Belayim, the people that became not like my family, but who I consider are my family. The first person I ever met in Belayim was a guy called Haitham. He was working as a filmmaker and would come out every night to document the crimes of the Israeli army, and of course every Friday to film the demonstrations. Since the campaign of nonviolent resistance had begun, Haitham lost his regular job as an electrician, his only form of income. And I remember asking Haitham, "Why do you sacrifice so much time and energy to do this?" And he said, "When I was 15 years old, I was arrested in a raid like this and thrown in jail for 2 years. And I don't want the boys now to feel as afraid and alone as I felt." Now, Haitham's 2-year-old son, a boy called Kami, was diagnosed with leukemia when he was just a few months old. Now, before the resistance began, Haitham would take his son to the hospital in Jerusalem every day to get treatment. But since Haitham started filming the raids and the demonstrations, the Israeli army refused to renew his permit to travel to Jerusalem. So for daring to play a part in this non-violent resistance, Haitham was punished with not being allowed to take his small son to hospital to get the treatment he needs to live. For nearly my whole time in Belayim, I was living with a young guy called Hamdi. He's 22 years old, working as a photographer, and has all the same ambitions and aspirations as me and you. But the only difference for him is that he faces the reality of being trapped under a military occupation We would sit up in his room together every night, listening to music, waiting for news of the next invasion, waiting to see who would be arrested next. But I can't count Handy as a friend of mine. 6 months is too long for that, so he's my brother and he always will be. Handy's oldest brother is a guy called Hamid. Now, during one of the Friday demonstrations, Hamid was shot in the head while he was standing with his arms in the air, shot in the head from around 20 meters away. He spent 2 weeks in a coma and several months after that in the hospital and still suffers from his injuries today. And you could tell because whereas all his brothers were laughing, jokey people, Hamid was a lot more serious and would get angry very easily over small things. But nevertheless, we became very close. And I remember once I was talking to Hamid about a week before I was due to leave the village. And he said to me, "Jody, I don't want you to leave because it will be like Bassem." And he was talking about Bassem Abu Rahma, his cousin, who was killed during one of the demonstrations in April of last year. Now, at the time Bassem was killed, this is one of the most active members of the community. At the time he was killed, he was standing at the front of the demonstration with his arms in the air, shouting at the soldiers, "Stop shooting because I think you've injured an Israeli activist." And they killed him there and then. Because this thing that is happening in Belayim, this is the thing that the Israeli government are most afraid of. Palestinians and Israelis standing side by side to oppose the occupation. One more person I want to tell you about from Belayim is a guy called Rani. Now, if you can imagine, when I arrived in this small Palestinian village to go to the demonstration, and I saw at the front of the crowd a person in a wheelchair like myself, I couldn't believe my eyes. So we became close, very close in fact. I mean, by the end of the 6 months I spent there, he was offering to find me a Palestinian wife. But I remember once talking to Rani, and I asked him, "Do you think the Israeli army treat you differently because you're in a wheelchair?" And he said, "Jody, I want to tell you two things. Firstly, I think you know by now, as well as I do, that the Israeli army do not care if you're walking or in a wheelchair or a man, woman or child." And that certainly rung true with what I had experienced. I remember during one night raid, a soldier rolling a sound grenade directly under my wheelchair so that it exploded into my face. And I remember during one demonstration, sitting at the front after most of the crowd had been forced back, and 6 Israeli soldiers simultaneously throwing tear gas at me as if I was some kind of threat to them. And the second thing I want to tell you, Rani said, is that it doesn't matter if you're in a wheelchair or not. What matters is the resistance and the ideas that are in your mind. Now, just before I left, Ronnie's wife gave birth to triplets, so he's a very strong guy in more ways than one. After 6 months in Belaim, I decided that I would travel to Gaza. So I made my way to Cairo in Egypt, where over 1,000 people were trying to do the same thing. Needless to say, I was the only one who succeeded. The Arabic I picked up in Belaim now came in handy. So when I got to each of the 5 checkpoints in the Sinai Desert that the Egyptian government had set up to stop people from traveling to Gaza, I said in Arabic, no, I'm Egyptian. I've forgotten my ID at home, but my father is waiting for me. And they said, okay, on you go. And some hours later, I was on my way to Gaza. I ended up crossing the border with an aid organization that had driven all the way from London to deliver aid. But once we got into the Gaza Strip, I realized that the Egyptian government was going to make them all leave after 24 hours. So after sleeping the first night in the hotel with them, I woke up early in the morning, walked downstairs, and walked out the front entrance. The security guards looked a little bit confused and said, excuse me, where are you going? You can't go off on your own, you can't have breakfast or something. And I said in Arabic, excuse me, I think there must have been some kind of mistake here. I'm not actually with this organization. My name is Ahmad Ali, I'm from Jabalia camp. And they said, okay, have a nice day.
This is my kid.
So I ended up living in Gaza for 2 months. And all I can say about Gaza is that the situation now is no better than it was a year and a half ago when Israel committed a massacre. The second night I was sleeping there, I woke up at around 2 a.m. to loud bangs outside my bedroom window. And Israel were bombing Gaza City. But of course, we don't hear about that here, because these victims do not matter. The people of Gaza continue to suffer under the siege every day. Farmers are shot at as they go to farm their land. People working in the tunnels to bring in food to the starving population are bombed. Fishermen working in Gaza waters are also shot at. But despite these feelings of desperation and immense depression, something that inspired me was that the non-violent resistance that I'd seen in Belaim and other villages in the West Bank was now spreading even to Gaza. So in the north, in an area called Beit Hanun, where the Israeli army had imposed a so-called buffer zone, an area of 300 meters next to the border that they declared no Palestinian could go to, despite the fact that farmers have land to farm there and families have homes that they live in there. So in response to that, men and women from the northern communities were marching into this strip of land every week to protest non-violently against this policy of the occupation. But the only difference between Belayin and Gaza was that in Belayin, the Israeli army were using every weapon they could lay their hands on. But in Gaza, only live ammunition, only bullets were used for the people of Gaza. But despite this, despite the fact that they know they're putting their lives on the line, the marches continue every week. So I think we need to take our strength from the strength of those people. Now, during my 9 months in Palestine, I was working as a journalist, writing regular reports for an online magazine from the UK called Control Alt Shift. But this magazine was funded by an organization called Christian Aid. Now, while I was in Gaza, I saw in the news that the Israeli president, Shimon Peres, was in the German parliament telling German politicians to hunt down all remaining Nazi war criminals. Now, in the article I wrote in response to this, I simply stated that if it was war criminals Shimon Peres was looking for, the first one he could find would be to look in the mirror. Now, in response to this, a man from the UK working for a very right-wing organization funded by the Israeli government wrote an article about me in the Guardian opinion section stating that I was anti-Semitic and a supporter of terrorism. Now, I must say that at first I had to take these claims as compliments. I found the publicity very flattering. But what angered me was that the response of Christian Aid was to go into the magazine of this website and delete not only every article that I'd ever written, but every article mentioning the word Palestine. Now, this is disgusting behavior. So, in response to this, my close friend Loki, who's going to be performing later on, will be writing a letter to Christian Aid in support of my work and against this censorship. So, if you'd like. To sign this letter, I think the organisers will be handing around some paper, and if you could just write your name and email address, that would be excellent. But this is only part of what we are seeing as a wider campaign of suppression of pro-Palestinian voices. But in my view, the most important thing now is how we respond to these efforts. We must not bow down, but instead, we must increase our action. Because as Malcolm X once said, if you don't stand for something, then you'll fall for anything. So I think it's time, as British and American citizens, that we stood up with the Palestinians. But it is my opinion that now it is not only important what we are doing, but how we are doing it. We need to adopt the Black Panther philosophy of each one, teach one, if we want to make this movement grow. You know, in Sheikh Jarrah, the neighborhood in Jerusalem, where I was evicted with the Hanoum family, they started a demonstration every Friday. And I went to the first ever one, and there was maybe 30 or 35 people. Now, there are 500 people every week marching. So this is how we can make a movement grow. But also, we need to be more direct in our actions. I think if the people in Palestine are putting their lives on the line every week to protest non-violently against the occupation, then we can be risking a lot more to stand beside them. As Martin Luther King once said, an injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And we have a moral responsibility as citizens of countries supporting the Israeli government to do something about it, not only through our words, but also through our actions. I want to leave you with a quote from the famous Palestinian writer Edward Said. He said, "This is a moral mission for each of us to pursue. By not forgetting, by reminding each other and the world of the continued injustice against us, I simply cannot imagine that history will ever excuse us for failing in this task." Thank you very much.